This is the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media. Now, here's Jason Jones.
Aloha, everybody, and welcome to the Jason Jones Show. I am your host, Jason Jones. We have a great guest today, my good friend Zaya. She is a writer, director, producer. She is an author. She wrote a brilliant, beautiful children's book. And she's most well known as a recording artist. She has a beautiful video out there called Monster. It's in the show notes. We're going to talk about it. You need to watch it. It's informed by the writings of Renee Girard. But her poem, in response to the Google searches of 2020, her visual, audiovisual poem is really something I wish everyone in the world could watch. And so that's why I wanted to have her on. We're going to talk about 2020. We're going to talk about Renee Girard, Wendell Berry. We're going to talk about Dallas Willard. This conversation is wide-ranging. And but she is one of the most talented and wonderful people I know. So it is a privilege for me to introduce you to Zaya. Make sure you watch the videos in the show notes, maybe before you listen to the interview. And but make sure you come back. You know, you're never supposed to send them away, because you go away, then the phone rings, Amazon Prime knocks, drops something off at the door. You know, you get distracted. But go to the show notes, watch the videos, and then make sure you come on back. Let's get on with the interview. This show is being brought to you by Movie to Movement, our new movie, Divided Hearts of America, as of today, starring Benjamin Watson, is streaming everywhere. So wherever you download movies, our film, Divided Hearts of America, is there, where Benjamin Watson goes on an exploration to discover the secret to unite America. He looks at what's dividing us, and he discovers the secret to unite America. Look for Divided Hearts of America wherever you download movies. The show, this episode, is also being brought to you by MyPillow. You know I've been using it for over a month now, and I love MyPillow. They don't go flat. You can wash them. You can dry them as many times as you want, and they hold their shape. They are made in the USA, which means you do not have to worry about forced labor in the manufacture into this pillow. And the pillow is just the beginning. I didn't know about the Giza Dream Sheets and the mattress topper until they became a sponsor and they sent me all of their products. And I have to tell you, if they said, Jason, you have to give up all your products, you can only keep one, I would keep the mattress topper. You've got to get the mattress topper, the Giza Dream Sheets. I have stray cats from the neighborhood now. They come in my house and they run right to my... I'm not kidding you. I probably shouldn't admit that. But it's true. It's true. We have a neighbor cat that comes in the house, runs right to my Giza Dream Sheets. But all these products are available with deep discounts using the code Jones. Go to the Radio Listener Square on the MyPillow.com site. Use the code Jones for all of the products, and you get the deep discount. All right, on with the interview. Here we go. Zaya on the Jason Jones Show. Aloha, Zaya. Welcome to the Jason Jones Show.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. We're snowed in here, so I've just been at home, which I guess is similar to the way this whole year has been.
Well, that's why I wanted to have you on. I watched your poetry film, which was really one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And so many of your videos have millions and millions of views. And this needs millions and millions of views too. And I'll help you get 100 more downloads from being on this podcast. That's what that's going to do. But you're an artist. You're a singer-songwriter. You're a poet. You're a children's book author. By the way, I love your children's book because it's like a children's book for adult children. That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's my favorite genre.
But it's like a kid's book, but really for kids that are already adults. Does that make sense? Is that what you were going for?
That is exactly what I was going for. Children's books for adults.
Yeah, Momica. So you're a singer-songwriter. In my memory, one of your songs was inspired by a book I either gave you or told you to read. I forget. Is that true? Or do I just insert myself into every story because I'm nuts?
You 100% gave me the book recommendation, which I'm so happy about. Renee Girard's I See Satan Fall Like Lightning.
And then
I ordered it and read it, so I followed through, which I don't always do with every book recommendation, but I loved it, and it was around that time that I wrote the song Monster, which, you know, I hadn't meticulously planned to write the song based on that book, but sometimes with the prophetic approach I have towards art, anything that I'm consuming finds its way into the art. So now looking back, it's like, wow, this is so much of what that book was saying, but it wasn't necessarily a conscious choice.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about the reason I'm having you on is I want to talk about your response to Google's year in review, or the most searched word of the year. But before we do that, let's talk about Monster. So it was after, and guys, go to the show notes, read I See Satan Fall, and watch the video, which is powerful and beautiful, and millions of views, millions of downloads. And so you were saying after you wrote it, you realized, oh, Renee Girard influenced this. So it wasn't that you sat down and said, I'm inspired by Renee Girard, let me write a song. You wrote it and you realized this has been the influence of Girard on me.
Yes. And I think that in general, that is usually my approach. I don't like when something feels too agenda driven. I like when it's just like the honest art. But, you know, when I consume something, whether it's a book or a new thought or a conversation, it does find its way into my subconscious. So I think, and I will also say, I wrote this song with Tommy Prophet and Lauren Strom, and they have not read the book, so we all wrote it together. But reading back the lyrics, I've just been surprised how accurate they are to the climate this year, and the mimetic contagion and the scapegoating and all of that. So,
And I've shared your video with every Girardian I know. Girard, to me, I took pleasure, a strange pleasure in 2020, as if witnessing everything Girard taught come to life all around me. Because in a way, a lot of what he writes about, by the grace of God, we haven't experienced in our lifetime.
Right. Which I'm very thankful for.
Which we're very thankful for. But then in 2020, and maybe even worse in 2021, sort of the cancel culture, the scapegoating, the mobs, the mob violence, and the scapegoating that goes along with mob violence. It just was, I felt like I was living in a social experiment come to life. And I just, something I told my children and my friends, this is a year of developing historical empathy. That we can understand other people in other places and other times, because we're experiencing sort of this violent, cruel, you know, this empathy. There was no empathy, and because you can't have empathy for a scapegoat.
Right.
And so it's just, it came to life for us in 2020, and maybe it's worse in 2021. And that's why I think your poem, A Local Year in Search, 2020, and I love how you said the year of perfect vision. What did you say? You said a year of perfect vision
has left us blinder than ever.
What was...
Because we were all looking forward to 2020 as, like, back in 2010, people had these 10-year plans and, like, looking forward to 2020, all these goals, and the world's going to get better and brighter. And it's just ironic that 2020 was the way that it was. So confusing and polarizing and, you know, all of a sudden you're not having conversations in person anymore. You're having them on these binary platforms, social media. And so it's been confusing for a lot of people who are in multiple spaces. Like, if you're not in an echo chamber, I guess I'll phrase it this way. if your social group doesn't think exactly the way you do, this year was confusing and hard to navigate because you kind of had to like constantly go between the extremes and the shaming and, you know, like you mentioned, the mob. And so that's in my personal experience, which is what led me to take the perspective of, you know, what if I just look at this year on a local level versus a global level? Because I noticed all of the conversations around me, all of the heartbreak over the year were, they were mostly global disappointments or reactions to global news. And so I decided in this film to show instead of tell, like I could have been like local versus global and quote Wendell Berry's essays, but I wanted to just show the global year and the local year from my perspective.
Well, I thought that was beautiful. So, and I like how you said those of us who transcend tribes.
Yeah.
It was very, I had people, I said, like, I would call them and I'd say, there's nothing you can do to lose me as a friend. So just stop even trying.
Right.
And you know, they call me friends. Like would call me. I'm like, what? Where's this? Are you crazy? I'm not. Stop even trying. So, but it had to be harder for you because you were younger and you're an artist and you were living in New York City. I think now you're back with your family. I got that from your poem.
Yeah.
But by the way, which is in the show notes, guys. And, but how did you lose friendships this year?
That is such a good question.
Or last year?
If you had asked me a few weeks ago, I would say yes. And I recently had a conversation with a friend of mine who, we had had this, I mean, she's a close friend. I was in her wedding. And we almost lost our friendship over this polarization and this climate because, and not because of conversations we were having over the phone or real like dialogue, but on social media, like I don't post sweeping thoughts on social media just because I'm an artist. I think also I'm highly sensitive. Have you heard of HSP, the highly sensitive person?
No.
Okay.
Is that a thing?
It is a thing. And it's something I discovered this year.
I probably chase those people away. Like I guarantee you there is not one HSP person that listens to this podcast.
That's so interesting.
I probably have never known one for more than 30 seconds. I mean, but you, so we're friends. So what is the HSP?
Well, the HSP is, it's a book, The Highly Sensitive Person.
Oh, okay.
And I scored nearly a 100% on the test of high sensitivity. And so I think this year for me has been like so hard navigating. I'm sensitive. And just, you know, just to give a brief overview of the book, they talk about, or she talks about sensitivity. Not just emotional sensitivity, but like maybe loud noises bother you, bright lights. A lot of highly sensitive people are introverts. You have awareness, emotional awareness. Like if you're in a room of people, you can tell what's going on immediately just by sensing the energy in the room. So it's a great book. You should definitely read it. But I have kind of leaned on that as a way to identify myself because I have really struggled with the sensationalized negativity of news. So that's number one. Number two, I've struggled with I guess it does go back to the sensationalized negativity of news, which now includes social media, because anyone with a profile, an Instagram, a Facebook account becomes like their own little news outlet. So a lot of the information you're receiving is negative and shameful towards anyone that thinks differently than you. And so I have found myself circling back to why I don't usually post online. I just, as an artist, I have a very broad social sphere. I'm aware every time I post something who I'm excluding, and not that inclusivity is the religion I ascribe to, but in my language and my approach, I like to have a real conversation, which is part of why I want it to be on this podcast, because it's a conversation. It's not a, you know, standalone comment on social media that could get reposted into all these places that I don't know where it is. I don't know who's posting it. And it just goes back to the global perspective of, like, you're so far removed from the information that you're reading. And that's what I started to, I mean, that's when I really broke it down to this concept of local versus global and local news versus global news.
So in your poem, you start out how sorrowful the year was because you're receiving all this global news. Yes. You're in New York City transcending multiple tribes. All of us are being forced into battles and forced into division. I just read the Acts of the Apostles today. And what was amazing about it was, and I was like, this is like now. Constantly people stirring up mobs, constantly trying to create division, constant appeals to violence, constant appeals to authority. So that's what's global right now. And those of our closest friend, every battle becomes total war. Every disagreement, and we're not allowed to disagree on anything. It's strange. Mm-hmm. It's sorrowful. And I realized I'm more or less, I quit Twitter. I quit Instagram, gone. And I tried to disable Facebook, and then a friend's like, yo, you're still on Facebook. It's still there. I'm trying to disable it. I'm like, okay, I'm moving to this other site for my podcast, social media site. I'll kind of leave it there, but I'm not even checking it daily. And I'm just sharing articles that I write in my podcast because all the reasons I had Facebook, right? Why did we have Facebook? My goal was to reconnect with old friends. I had my army buddies 10 years ago, Facebook for me was my army buddies talking to my friends on my wall that I went to elementary school with, talking to someone I had just met the week before. There were these beautiful conversations. That's how it started. And then I realized, what is Facebook now? My army buddies calling my friend from elementary school a moron. My friend from elementary school called my army buddy a fat pig. Like, this is not, I didn't sign up for this. This is gone. I'm done. I don't want any part of this. And
I feel the same way.
Right? But the podcast is the anti-social media in a way because you can have really broad, nuanced conversations where we can respect each other and we're allowed to disagree. We are allowed, I think we're allowed to disagree, right? And one of the things with social media that we probably all do if we want to say anything is we hurt people. And then we don't mean to, but again, we don't know the context of the 5,000 people are going to see what you post. And we don't know what place they are. We don't know what they experienced today. We don't know we don't know how they're going to take a little comment I would put on an issue. It might strike them at the wrong time in the wrong way. And it was meant for this person talking about this. You have no control over it. And I don't know if I'm a highly sensitive person, but I can tell you I'm addled by I don't want to hurt anyone. Like I don't want to hurt someone's feelings. I don't want to place burden on someone. And I do, by the nature of what I do for a living, I talk about really tough, challenging issues that can be hurtful to people. So I know that's something I can do very easily, that happens probably quite a bit, and I'm addled by it. I don't want to do that. So Facebook, Twitter especially. I mean, Twitter is pure. There's nothing good that could ever come from Twitter.
Yeah. Well, it's one of the questions I've been asking is social media a private or a public space? And if it is a public space, like for myself, I've been comparing social media to a mall. Like if I walk into a mall, I'm going to wear clothing because it's respectful to other people. I'm probably going to only talk to people that I know because it would be weird to go up to a stranger and just tell them all of my opinions about something. And so what I think is really strange is that we're treating social media as a private space when it's a public space. And then in the public space, there's no politeness. There's no rules for politeness.
That's like brilliant.
Right? Like we have thousands of years of
Like, yeah, if it's a public space, then yeah, treat it so, like a public space. But we want both. We want both worlds. We want.
Well, I think it's confusing because maybe it is a private space for you. Like, some people have their Instagram set to private. And some people, like we mentioned before, you're in a tribe and everyone thinks the way that you do. So it kind of could function like a private space, but if you have a diverse social group, if you work in an institution that ideologically is different than the family you came from or the place you grew up, then you don't have the luxury to be thin in your dialogue. Like, you have to think of everyone when you post something. So then additionally, what I think is happening is that we're actually getting a wrong view of what people are even thinking. Like, I realized one day, when I go on Instagram, I see maybe 10 or 15 screamy posts from different people who are upset about something. Sometimes they're upset about the same thing, sometimes it's different things, but they're just the people shouting the loudest. Whereas there's hundreds of people who are keeping their thoughts to themselves because maybe they're also being sensitive the way I'm being sensitive, but I never hear from them. So I don't get to see that represented on my feed.
Oh. Yeah, it's sad. It's you know what, it's a challenge. I think it's a new technology. We tried to navigate it and I realize I just can't. Either you keep it to 120 people, you never talk about things that are important.
Right.
And my tribe, like yours, is very diverse. And I've always like celebrated how my Facebook page was the town hall where I would allow, I mean, you would not believe, I don't know if you ever look at the conversations that used to take place on my Facebook, but I mean, you know, people from all over the world, all walks of life, having great conversations. Sometimes someone would get out of line and I'd say, hey, listen, the only rules I had was this. You can say anything you want about me, any ad hominem attack in me, because I invited you onto my page. Say what you want. You can even make ad hominem attacks against other people on my page that you know. So if you went to high school with me and there's another guy we went to high school with and you want to like go at it, go at it. The only thing I ask is that you respect my friends that you don't know on my page, period. And I don't care if you agree with me, you're defending me. If that's my friend, my cousin, my uncle, you be respectful. Now, if you guys are friends, you have a relationship outside of me, have at it. It just seemed to me like a simple rule. That rule was maintained until about the middle of until COVID. The shutdowns, yeah. I don't know if it was the shutdowns, the tension of politics. I don't know what it was, but then all of a sudden it became unmanageable. And I just realized I got to shut this down.
Yeah.
Now, so you said you lost a friend, but now you didn't. So you've mended that relationship?
Oh, yes. You know, I hope this encourages someone who's listening. My really good friend had, you know, just been very extreme on Instagram. I had posted something, I think actually the only quasi-political thing I had posted, which actually within the post was talking about the unity of two different people who agreed and how, you know, they disagreed, but they didn't hate each other. And I was celebrating that, but sometimes even to celebrate something is not okay anymore. So I posted that and she had responded with, you know, all of this fanaticism. And I was just like, hey, I have been quiet about some of the things that I think around you because you frame a conversation with the crazy people who think this. So I'm not going to come into that conversation with like, well, actually I'm one of those crazy people, right? Like, you immediately shut down the conversation when you approach it that way. And what's amazing is we scheduled a phone call. We had a long conversation just outlining where we think differently. And she agreed to everything that I was frustrated with. She even admitted that I was one of the only people, I think actually the only person she knew who thought differently than her in this one area we were discussing. And actually what has been amazing is we've now had this back and forth text chain of discussions based on things she reads, and she kind of uses me as a way to say, like, hey, what do you think of this? And to me, that's really redeeming. Like, we decided we're not going to lose a friendship over this. But again, the reconciliation happened over the phone in on a medium that facilitates conversation. So I don't know. Are you familiar with Marshall McLuhan's The Media, or The Medium is the Message?
Okay, it's so funny you should say that. In a previous podcast, I was quote, so one of the reasons I'm breaking off of big tech, I'm writing an article, I meant to write it last week, I didn't, I'm calling for a big tech-sit. We need to exit big tech. And the reason why is I was writing a speech that I had to give, I was practicing a speech or something, that I was giving to an organization somewhere, I think in Arizona, and they want, because of COVID, they canceled it, we were going to do it over Zoom. And I, in the speech, I quoted him, the medium is the message. And therefore, I quoted him in my speech. And so I was, as I was practicing it, I said, you know, and yada, yada. Yeah. I had to ask myself, how should I dress? How should I present myself for the speech? Well, the medium is the message. And what is the message of Zoom? You're in my office. I'm in your living room. So I'm going to dress the way I would dress if I had you over to my house for dinner. I'm not going to wear a suit. I'm not going to stand at a podium. You're going to be in my den. And this is how we are. Well, the next day, Facebook, Amazon, everywhere I get digital ads, they were advertising the book I was quoting. And I was like, they were listening to me in my room, my office at 2 a.m. But that idea, I think that's where you're going. The medium is the message. Twitter itself is a type of message, right? Is that what you're saying? Like, it, the format of social media is a message. And it's a very selfish, one-sided message.
Yes. It's like the this idea that whatever medium you're using changes the content you're saying. So in there was another book I had read called Amusing Ourselves to Death. Have you read that or heard of it?
I have read that, and I have heard of it too.
Amazing book. I love that book. And I remember that was just reading his perspective on the medium is the message, that phrase, and then also the Kennedy-Nixon debate, where the people who had listened to the debates thought that Nixon had won and the people who watched them thought Kennedy won, because the visual medium changes what you're saying. All of a sudden, you're focused on the appearance of confidence, your hair, your clothing, and so it's fascinating, actually, how you could say the same message through a book, podcast, over a phone call, over the television, and, you know, on Facebook, which I personally think Facebook and Instagram are the best examples of the medium is the message being like, you can just take something so out of context. And the medium itself is not designed for conversation, because it you're interacting with, like if you make a post and somebody responds, you can go back and forth with that person, but anyone else can chime in at any moment and change the entire conversation, which is so unlike real conversations that we have. Like, even around a dinner table, if somebody interrupts you halfway through your sentence, like, it's rude, right? And you would kind of just be like, hey, don't do that. But you have all of this physical energy of picking up cues, and I don't know, I feel so passionate about important conversations happening in the right medium. So that is something that relates to what you're saying, the text. Like, I've done the same thing. I've just been like, certain conversations I just don't want to have on these platforms, because in addition to being the wrong medium, they're also very binary. Like, you can only be this or this. And so if you are multifaceted in your thinking or nuanced, you're kind of just like forced into these two boxes.
And it's actually homogenizing us. It is turning us into like Diet Coke and Diet Pepsi. That's it. Yeah. That's all it's allowed. And yeah, and there's nothing else.
Yeah. I think it's actually making us kind of, I don't want to use the word stupid, because I think
banal.
It's even banal. That's a great word. I like that. it's banalizing us.
Yeah, it's sorrowful. So that's how your poem starts. So you start out there, you're transcending tribes, you're a singer-songwriter working in New York City, work is drying up, just as you, I mean, your career is really taking off. I'm watching you, I'm following you, all the things. Like, I tell people there's so much that is charming about Instagram. There is so much that is charming about Facebook. And, like, your Instagram page to me, was it was very charming to go peek in and to see your projects that you were working on, and you're like, you're just your tight knit little group of friends, and your poetry and story reading and your wine, you know, you're having your friends over for wine, and just very charming.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it hard, right? That's why we're so stuck to it. There is, I had to weigh it. I'm like, there's so many great things about, like I said, Twitter for the dogs. Nothing good ever came out of Twitter, but Instagram and Facebook, there is so much, I think, for me, charm in it. And so I could see your career is just blossoming, and you're having so much success, and you're doing so much work with all of your different projects, then COVID, and then things just chill, but you have normalcy bias. You're plugging along like things haven't changed, but then all of a sudden you have to acknowledge this isn't, something is different, and it becomes very dark for you. I mean, that's what we see, and for all of us, right? So in the poem, it's very dark. What was explain to us what it was like to leave. Like, what was your normal day like pre-COVID in New York City as an artist?
I would, depending on the day, I might have a meeting with a photographer. I was in the process of pitching a TV show. I would fly back to Nashville and do a week of songwriting sessions. So I would once a month do that. And then every Sunday night, I would perform at Bowery Poetry, which I loved. That was my favorite time of the week. And I would invite all of my friends. And I felt like, honestly, I lived in Nashville before I moved back to New York. And a big reason I made the move was because I realized as a musician, I would never fit into the culture of music, because deep down I'm more of a thinker and an intellectual. And the music industry, although there are a lot of artists who are very brainy, it's not the culture. Like, it's very centered around who's on stage, what are they wearing? They're running back and forth, looking cute, like feeling hot. And I just, like, I don't care. So I'm like, okay, this culture.
You were going through what Wendell Berry was going through in the 60s, yeah. Right? Where Wendell Berry was the hottest poet in the world. Is that a proper word to use for Wendell Berry? But it was true. He was in vogue, top of his game, and fled. So you realized that, and it is true. I mean, I would say this, the people I meet, like you, I meet the most brilliant, deep, thoughtful. I think you, like me, I'm an introvert that pretends not to be. I think you're kind of like that, maybe.
Yeah.
So that comes with challenges, but that's kind of what the whole entertainment industry is filled with, people like that, but they get swept up. This desire to be successful and the things that you have to do to be successful, when originally they just wanted to create. And then you have contracts and you have obligations, and you, as Eduardo Verástegui tells me, has this great analogy. It's, you know, we're all greyhounds chasing the mechanical rabbit, and what we're chasing is fake. It's a lie.
Yes.
And he said, you know, every once in a while the rabbit breaks, and a greyhound will catch it, and he will bite it, and he will bleed, but he's the luckiest greyhound around, because he'll never race again, because he knows he's chasing a lie.
Oof, I had chills.
Yeah, because I had once asked Eduardo, because, you know, we do, I get to be a voyeur. We get to, you know, I get to participate in that world. I'll fly in and fly out. It really never held an attraction to me. But I once said to Eduardo, I said, brother, we were at a party at Adam Sandler's, with Adam Sandler, that he was throwing. And, you know, everybody was there. And I said, brother, do you ever feel that you could be lured back into this world again? That you could, that the attraction. And he said, no. And that's when he told me the greyhound story. He said, you know, I had so much success so early. But of course, a lot of people have success early and they keep chasing the greyhound. It's so strange. But he said, for me, you know, I caught the rabbit. I hurt myself. I hurt other people. I would never chase it again because I know it's a lie. I know it's a lie.
Yes. I think for me, I didn't catch the rabbit as a whole. I caught like a half of its tail and just bled a little bit to be like, oh, I see where this is going. And the funny thing is, I don't even think, as an artist, I want to make great art. I have to be in the industry in some capacity to do that because you have to collaborate, you have to stay active, you have to stay sharp. But my decision to move back to New York was more a decision of like, what culture do I want to be in? What culture inspires me the most? And for me, that was the poetry community in New York. I wanted to perform somewhere that was centered around the words and the content. And I would sit in these rooms in Bower Poetry, and I was so surprised in our culture that's addicted to technology, dopamine addicted, like every time your phone buzzes, you're drawn to it, and it's this sickness. But in this room of people, whoever was on the stage, like everyone else would be quietly listening to them, absorbing the words. And I was like, okay, this is a space that I want to be in and grow in. And I want to bring my multimedia approach to this kind of space. Like, I know the listeners probably don't know this, but my poetry films, I perform live with a huge screen behind me so that while you're seeing this and hearing the spoken word, you're also seeing a film that I produced that matches the content. And it's really moving because there's music underneath it and everything is timed emotionally so that, and it's all meant to be a live performance. Because I just, like, even a few years ago, I realized these online spaces, they're too small for me. And I felt myself trying to squish into them. And I finally was just like, okay, you know what? I'm going to go find a space that accommodates real thought. And I found that in the poetry community. But then COVID happened. And hilariously, COVID happened right as I was booked as a featured poet representing Manhattan for this event, which is so sad. But
okay, so there's where you were. So
yeah.
You were living this beautiful life. You were, you know, you had great friends. You were close enough to your family in Pennsylvania. You could pop in and out, going back and forth to Nashville. And in the poem, was that empathy when you were expressing how dark the world was becoming? Or did it have that impact on you before you went home?
I was in the first part of the film, I was speaking from a global perspective. So I was trying to speak for the zeitgeist, like the mood of what all of my friends were feeling. So I'd say yes and no, like I felt a tinge of that. But because years prior, I had already made my exit strategy from getting all of my news and reality from this screen, I actually felt that my year was more like the local one that I described.
So even in New York, you were more or less protected because you already weren't being bombarded with them. You know, for me, it really struck me because I don't know if you know this, but I got caught up in it big time. Like, I was arrested on the cover of Drudge in handcuffs. Yes.
Okay, wait. Did not know that.
Yeah, you're like, why am I on the show? No, it was a good thing. It was actually a good thing. My wife was like, I've never been more proud of you. So, and I'm like smiling. I'm like, this ball is going to bounce so well. I was like, I'm not at all worried about this. You know, I like literally, I saw the photographers and I'm like smiling like, you know, I should have been serious. But no, because what happened for me, I'll tell you, I run a nonprofit and we have a very weird mission. I don't even know if you know how much about what we do, what I do. But through my nonprofit Hero, we have two programs, the Vulnerable People Project and Moving to Movement. And I really realized in college, but then later working for other organizations, that those who are truly the most vulnerable are abandoned from protectors because there's always a social cost to stand with the most vulnerable. And
right.
So that's what I always do. Every, you know, we always do these sort of operational pause is where we like, look, who is the most vulnerable people in the world with the fewest defenders? And we've been working, for example, with the Uyghur for many, many years, the Kurds, the Christians and Yazidis in Iraq. And food security is something that has always been something I've understood as part of democide, the greatest tragedies of the 20th century, the genocides and democides. And so this is something that I thought about, not nearly as much as I've thought about this year, but when I heard that Italy was locking down, I wrote an article around that time in February, a year ago, saying that if Europe and the United States follows this lead, it's going to lead to famine. And so I panicked, like we cannot follow the lockdown model because the cost is going to be much higher than any gain or reward. And so I started writing about how lockdowns, and I knew it wouldn't be 14 days. I said it even in February and March, this lockdown is going to be probably, you know, forever. Well, this is going to be a challenge to get out of this. And it's going to lead to just a small so I became just consumed by the thought of famine. And I thought just the smallest decrease in production, processing, and distribution of food will put the most vulnerable at risk. So I started leading the Reopen Hawaii events as soon as we closed down, like the first week, which led to me being, I think, the first person in the world arrested at a Reopen event. And it was on the front cover of Drudge above the fold, which is the best way to fill your phone. Like, you get a lot of phone calls and emails when you're above the fold in handcuffs in the Drudge Report. And so for me, the first, you know, half of the year was my organization. I felt like we're just being crushed, you know, and sadly, you know, what we had thought was going to happen happened. And it's been a devastating year for hunger, in spite of it being one of the best years ever, if maybe ever, for grain production. It was just because of distribution and other problems that were caused by the shutdowns and fear, you know, in the developing world. So for me, I the reason why your poem struck me is up until August, my obsession was Hawaii's food insecure. We rely on ships to bring us most of our 90% of our food. We're the most remote place in the world, and I can't travel to do my job, and the communities I'm working with are being crushed because, like, for example, Iraq had very brutal lockdowns. And so I was just addled by the global problem to the nth degree. Then in August, I realized the Titanic has hit the iceberg. Now my job is to focus on my children and my wife.
Right.
And sort of the same rhythm of your poem, from global to local. Now, not that I would ever forget the mission of my organization, and I pledge that as I focus more on my family, I would amplify even more our work and our message, and by God's grace, we were. But like you, I would have to say, I live a charmed life. And do you struggle with this? You know, because you said in the poem, you end with this. I wrote notes and I can't find my glasses.
do you remember the visual was?
You talked about. I can't even remember. I don't know. It's actually now at this point. It's not. I don't have glasses. It's my. I have the glasses on. It's my handwriting. So I can't even. You didn't have to worry about the suffering in the world because you have a savior who carries the world's suffering.
Oh, right. Yes. But the ending of the poem.
Do you ever, this is the ending of the poem struck me because I would say something, maybe it's my biggest question for God. In a world with so much sorrow and suffering, I live like a pharaoh. I'm not wealthy or powerful, but I have a home full of books and children with musical instruments and a refrigerator filled with wholesome food, and I have a My Pillow and a mattress topper with the Giza Dream sheets. You should know they're our sponsor. So I feel like that. Use the code Jones. You could have it too with those deep, deep discounts. But yeah, do you struggle with that sort of, I call it the problem of grace. You know, there's the problem of pain. How could there be an all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful God? And I'm hurting so much. My question is, I always hate saying this out loud because God's like, oh, I can help you with that right now. But how can there be an all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful God with so many people suffering? And like, I live in a valley with a beautiful river and flowers everywhere and birds singing and my children running around. So when I watched your poem, you know, you set the local within all of this suffering. And your local was so beautiful. It was like a glimpse of my life. Like it was just, it was, you live by going home to be with your family in the midst of all of this.
Yeah.
Even though your dad got COVID and you fought through that, you live a charmed life in a world filled with so much suffering.
Yeah. And, you know, I think I struggle with it too. And I think maybe the reason we got into the spaces that we're in as filmmakers and artists is born out of this desire to mitigate that suffering or help. Or I love this quote by Dallas Willard. I read this book years ago, probably when I was a teenager, and I still remember this one line that says, "The killing fields of Cambodia happen because of philosophical conversations in Paris."
100% true.
Yeah, and so I just
Sartre and the killing fields in Iraq and Iran.
Yeah, and everywhere. I mean,
that's right.
Suffering is always born from an idea, even if it's just the idea of envy or bitterness. It's still this abstract thing that lives in your brain that comes out in your actions. And so I think that my real discontentment is with this idea that I'm a good person by being aware of all the global suffering, but doing nothing about it on a local level.
Do you ever listen to this podcast?
I have not. I will though.
Shame on you. So no, but I often will say is, look, if we are aware, because this show was founded, what I say is we talk about, you know, I founded the show to learn how to be charming and entertaining. And when you're not paying attention, I talk about genocide, democide, and war. And so that's often our topics, right? So,
right.
But to listen, to be a voyeur, it's to get an emotional catharsis, some sort of emotional response to hearing of a tragedy is more wicked than sticking your head in the sand, isn't it?
Right. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it. I like that visual because this is new. So I have a lot of grace for me and my friends and for everyone, because it really is the first time in history, this last however many years, decades, where we've even had the opportunity to take global suffering on our shoulders. And I remember having a argument with my friend who lives in India years ago. She was getting on my case for not reading the news more. And I told her back then, before any of this was an issue, I was like, I don't know why it's my responsibility to be aware of every single thing that's happening in the world when I can't do something about it. And so like, why is that ethically seen as moral? Like being aware has been confused with being a good person. And I look at the people I admire most, and they're just day after day, like even the nuns that I study in Provence, they are already cloistered. Like they've signed up for a whole life of quarantine and they don't know what's happening. I mean, when I visit them, I talk to them about problems in America and they're like, oh yeah. And they're just doing what they do best. They live a life of prayer. They farm, they take care of each other. And that's a whole vocation in itself. And everyone has a different vocation. And maybe someone's vocation, they have to read the news constantly because they're a thought leader and they're responsible to get the right information out there, whatever it might be. But for me,
but even those thought leaders have to be thought leaders, have to be very narrow so they can be deep in the information that they consume. If you're talking about, you know, trying to, you know, save minorities from the calamity of American foreign policy, you know, you're focused on Iraq or Yemen or Syria or you know,
right.
Well, I mean, half the world at this point, but you know what I mean? You have to be very narrow. I get a lot of angry emails from people to the Vulnerable People Project saying, why are you talking so much about Iraq or the Uyghur and not us? And I have to write them back and say, listen, I am not culpable for what is happening in your country, but I have products filling up my house that are made by forced labor in Chinese occupied East Turkestan. So as an organization, right, we have to focus on those tragedies that we are actually involved in, that I am participating in and benefiting from the oppression of the Uyghur. As I'm talking to you, I'm looking at an iPhone. I'm looking at a MacBook. I wish sometimes, God, I wish everything in this house that was touched by someone in forced labor could just glow so I could know, you know, because there's so many products in our homes, I'm sure. So this is where we need to focus. And what good does it do? You're right. Other than we should pray for the persecuted and vulnerable people around the world. But being a do-gooder is a really nasty thing where you just, you know, for social prestige, you pontificate on issues you don't know much about and can't do anything about, right?
And I just feel this year and last year solidified for me. I'm drawing a line in the sand that I'm not going to be that person. And even in 2021, I've made a really conscious effort to be more involved on a local level. Even the question of locality for me is kind of complicated because I've lived in a few different places. And so I have to answer the question, where am I a local person?
Tribal. It's your tribal level. Like your tribe. Yeah. You know, your tribes, you have your tribes in New York, your tribes in Nashville. You know, your tribe is not just there in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, my mom runs a school in Pennsylvania that is incredible. And I've been spending more time with my family because of COVID. And I found out actually about this tax program in Pennsylvania where businesses and people who make over $100,000 a year can sign up for this program and designate 90% of their state tax to any private school of their choice. And when I heard about this, I was like, wait, what? Like, I'm making a video about that. I'm promoting that. I'm helping my mom's school because I think if people really knew about that, they would have a concrete, and obviously only some people can do it because you have to either own a business or make a certain amount of money. But it's like, I really think if we start concentrating on the local level, we'll stop being in this cycle of complaining and shaming. And I mean, I had full on panic attacks this year because I would see a post and like the trigger system in my body had just been, I'm so exhausted by all of this negative energy that I got to the point where I'm like, it's not even really a choice anymore. Like, I can't look at my phone because it truly will ruin the rest of the day and render me completely useless to anyone around me and the things I'm involved in. So I'm really just a month into the cold turkey, like really sticking to rules on how I engage with social media. And making this film for my mom's school is a great example because I'm not going to be famous for making this film. Like, it actually has nothing to do with my artistry for Zaya. But I'm like, this is how I can help on a local level because if I make this film and X amount of people see it, that means, you know, maybe 10 underprivileged children can go to this incredible private school that personalizes education and has a classical approach. And I'm like, okay, that is me saying, you know, and to circle it back to the film, closing out the film with, you know, I didn't want to be cheesy and end it on like a cheesy note, but I rewrote the ending to that film like probably 25 times. Because I was like, ugh, I don't want to be too grand or too abstract. Like, I want it to really be the right idea that I'm closing with. And to say that I have a savior who carried the weight of global suffering so I don't have to is my way of actually saying I'm not a god. I worship a god who has omniscience and omnipotence, but but I serve that God. I'm not that God. And I think sometimes the temptation with the internet and even with global efforts to fix the world is that we're trying to be God.
We're trying to save the world. You know, Mother Teresa didn't try to save the world. Do you know her quote about the bucket?
No, tell me.
Okay, Mother Teresa was asked, you know, you're doing all this work in India and, you know, you're not making a dent and there's the sea of human suffering around you. Why are you doing this? And she says, I'm not tending to a sea of human suffering. I wake up every morning, I grab my bucket, I walk up to that sea, I dip my bucket into the sea, I bring my bucket home, and I tend to my bucket.
Oh.
Tend, we're all called to tend to our bucket. Now, we have different buckets.
Yeah.
I, by who I had as college professors and my experiences in the military and who my friends were, my tribe is in Sudan and in Iraq and in East Turkestan. But that most, you know, that's, I didn't go seeking that. And if you're a dentist and you're making sure everyone in your community isn't walking around with a toothache every day, that's your bucket. What a beautiful bucket that is.
Right.
If you're a teacher opening up the world to students every year, what a beautiful bucket that is. Today I was, earlier today I was at the boxing gym. And I love my boxing gym. I just love it. It's in the barrio. It's in this neighborhood, you know, Spanish neighborhood. And, you know, the radio stations are all Spanish language radio stations and all these kids. And this young kid came up to me today, young to me. I'm 50. He was probably like 23. He goes, "Mister, you know, you train so hard. You work out so hard. You inspire me." And he goes, why do you train so hard? I said, "I train so hard because I have a job. I think my job is very important. And I see that this trains my spirit to be good at my job. And so I'm here to train my spirit to be good at my job. So that's why I push myself so hard." He goes, "Well, you make me push myself hard, you know, and I got my first pro fight coming up." And I said, "Well, even your pro fight, all your career as a fighter," I said, "that is really just a sacrament for how you're going to live your life as a father, as you go beyond boxing, and I hope you're a champion, but you go beyond it, whatever you do, this is just how you're going to live your life." And he goes, "Well, hey, I just want you to know I watch you. You know, you're an old man." And I'm like, "I got to train harder than that old man." And I thought, that's the best thing I could have done today. Just going to the boxing gym, right? He's looking. And, yeah. And that to me is like, that's what we all have a chance to do, that locally every day. That's what I hate about these masks. We can't smile at people. I love smiling at people that no one smiles at, talking to people that no one talks to.
Yeah, yeah. So that makes sense.
And right. Was that a sneeze or a dog?
No, that was me changing the log in my fire. So it keeps going.
That's that's awesome. We've never had anyone change a log in a fire. We've had dogs bark a lot. We've had the Amazon Prime truck show up quite a bit. We never had.
Well, I have to keep it going or it will die and then it'll take so much effort to resurrect.
So do you have, is it very cold in Penn? You guys got the snowstorm. My wife is in New York City sending me pictures. She's just dumped with snow. Are you covered with snow in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, it's so beautiful.
It is beautiful, but after 31 years in Hawaii, it's more beautiful when I see you on Instagram standing in the snow than me standing in the snow.
I have to get
out to Hawaii. Well, hey, I want everyone, you got to go in the show notes. You got to watch Monster. You have to watch 2020, the global local poem. And I it should be your most viral of poems because so many of my friends that I sent it to said it just made them cry and it gave them chills.
Aww,
and you captured everything. Yes, you captured everything that when we look at the world, we're miserable. But when we look at those closest to us, this treasure all around us, our family and our friends, we can have a beautiful life. But then you even deal with the problem of one of the things that got me so mad, and I've ranted a lot about on this podcast, is when my friends would call me up and go, "Oh, 2020 was such a great year for me. I reconnected with my family and I had just had a lot of time and I got to work from home so I didn't have to commute." I'd be like, "Yeah, okay, you weren't starving to death. You're not a single mom with bad Wi-Fi and three kids trying to do Zoom classes. And they're not, and their unemployment check, like in Hawaii, is 6 months late. Oh, glad it was good for you because you could meditate and be close to your kids, you know." But you even dealt with that in the poem. You're like, "Listen, there's all of this going on around me, But when I focused on what's closest to me, it was quite beautiful. And yet,
there is
a world of suffering around me, and we're not thoughtless to that. And that's what I really loved, because if that wasn't there, I would have probably been offended. I get offended by it. I'm like, you know, I'm not a highly, what do you call it? I don't know if I'm a highly sensitive person. Is that HSP? Is that right?
HSP, yeah.
I don't think I'm an HSP. I hate to admit, two things I hate to admit, that you can't tell anybody. I am a cat person. I lie and I tell people I'm a dog person. Because guys that are cat people are weird. I'm a cat person. And I love cats. But I tell people I'm a dog person. And then two, I shouldn't say this, but like I'm empathetic to maybe a fault. Like it can ruin me. If I hear of a U.S. drone strike that kills 36 women and children in Yemen, that ruins my month, you know, because I feel responsible for that.
Yeah.
And I can feel it. I can see it. I can see the sorrow in the eyes of the father coming into his home that's smoldering and his family's gone. And so the impact of the COVID shutdowns and the ham-fisted policies of the world's governments, sort of the thoughtlessness to the vulnerable that have fallen through the cracks of our response. Did you see the New Yorker cover? It was like some chic woman sitting, this was I think last month, sitting in front of her computer doing a Zoom chat, probably surrounded by like Uber Eats containers and a wine glass in her hand. It was like, you know, like that's what our year was. Yeah, great. That's what your year was.
Oh, yeah.
But don't that's not most people's year, okay? Like, let's, can we,
yeah.
There's a lot of people that are working at the Amazon distribution center, food processing, their life was much different. There's a lot of...
Well, yeah, somebody delivered that food to you. I mean, Jason, I am 100% on the same page. Like, and New York is, you know, the example of this thought, because in my neighborhood, 40% of people left within the first 4 or 5 months of COVID. And it's because they couldn't live there anymore. Like, so 40% of people had to leave, and the people who stayed could afford to live there and stay in their Hamptons home or go to a family, or, you know, my family is close by, so I could go to my family. But like, even for me, I lost my job this year because in addition to the industry, I run a wedding videography business, and that's the events industry, which has been hit hardest. And so I lost my job and never had anticipated that happening, because business had doubled every year and done so well. And so like, I actually had to make a conscious choice in this film. I could have made a film dwelling on all of the negatives of my local year. But I wanted to include it briefly, because I think in the grand scheme of things, there are people who have it a lot worse than me. Like you said in the beginning of this call, they couldn't be locked in with a healthy family. Maybe, you know, they're in an abusive situation, or they have nowhere to go. And I think that what's been really frustrating about getting our news and our information from the sources that we do and having these global cultural moments, it's too thin. Like, I'll actually, because I know we're probably closing, but Wendell Berry has an essay that I love outlining basically the difference between global thinking and local thinking. And he says, properly speaking, global thinking is not possible. Those who have thought globally have done so by means of simplifications too extreme and oppressive to merit the name of thought.
Now, what essay was that?
This essay is called, so it's in a book called Sex, Economy, Freedom, and Community.
I love that book. Sorry, I was wondering if it was. So yeah. Yeah, you know, that's probably where I got the idea. I tell people, think local, act local. Do you know what thinking global, acting locally is? That's called imperialism. That's like, that's fascism. What do you mean, think global, act local? You become an instrument for some distant homogenized ideology? No, think local, act local.
Oh, Jason, I don't know why more people aren't talking about the local global thing. It really is concerning to me.
You know, because the global, powerful, you know, wealthy, transnational, you know, ideology that lends itself to that, there's this homogenizing impulse. And, you know, it's sorrowful. It's really sorrowful, this idea. And it really has to do about distant, unelected power, where to me, you know, everything beautiful is close to home. And And I guess because you and I, from young ages, had to leave home, had to leave our friends, our family. I mean, I know I did and got shoved all over the world. You know, you can romanticize the local. That's not perfect because, of course, all sorts of contradictions and horrible things can exist in small little communities. And so that's what the global is. Like, we're going to purge every filthy remnant of the past that survives in local communities. But what's the cost in doing that?
Right.
The truth is, yes, a lot of dark things live that are sheltered in local communities, but so do most of the beautiful things in our lives are also sheltered by those local communities. So I think I think it's this utopian impulse that we can purge the local communities of every historical vice or sin.
Yeah, and I think that is, I like that you used the word utopian, because I'm seeing my friends, just this obsession to poke holes in what already exists, when maybe they've never done the work of creating something. And it's like so much easier to destroy or poke holes in something than to create something. And once you create something, and this is why I love listening to small business owners, you know how hard it is to do anything, how hard it is to get something off the ground. And the people who thrive are usually working off of ideas that are good. Like, inherently those ideas work, and that's why, and maybe there's other factors of why the business does well, but I think that we should be listening and paying attention to what works, not 100%, but maybe like 80-85%. And I've even been toying around with this philosophy for my own life. Instead of criticizing that 5 or 2% or 10 or whatever it might be, I want to almost follow this 85% rule, where I'm like, okay, is it working in the 85%? Then let me encourage that and get out of this mindset that I walk into every situation and I'm just like criticizing what's, you know, picking out what's wrong about it. And even like, I think we apply this to our country and our, you know, like, we've come so far even in social issues. Like, I'm a woman. I'm so thankful that I have the right to vote and I have the right to work. And I feel so thankful for the people who have done all of this work before me so that I can benefit from it. But I'm celebrating that. And I feel like there's this like progressive hunger to just keep going and keep going. But then it's like, at what point are we actually going backwards? Because instead of just like building in other ways or paying attention to, you know, the new set of people who are suffering, we just keep progressing at a rate that actually becomes regressive, you know?
Yeah, no, it's sorrowful. You know, you brought up Wendell Berry. Have you read his Port Arthur stories or collection of short stories?
I have not.
Oh, you need to. You know, and yeah, so what it is, and it's been a while. I went through a total Wendell Berry phase, and I have to be honest, I do think the spirit of the age has tugged on him a little bit. You know, he's
what do you mean by that?
You know, he held, I don't want to drag you into this conversation, but he held very strongly as a Christian, defending the traditional, how do I put this so you don't get in trouble for being on my, he, you know, he was a, he was a strong voice for marriage.
Okay.
As being between a man and a woman, and a very strong voice for the defense of life. He was a strong pro-life advocate.
Oh, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, very outspoken on traditional marriage and on life. And then maybe about a decade ago, I think, he just kind of collapsed. And the way I see it is, again, going to Gerard, the spirit of the age is so powerful that, you know, that we all don't conform to it is a mystery. And I just think as somebody who loves probably, I think it's always comes down to something personal. There are probably people around him he loved so much and he wanted them to be assured of his love for them that he just no longer was willing to be thrust into the front of this debate. Because being Wendell Berry, he couldn't help but be in the front of the debate.
Right.
And he was probably just tired and said, listen, I'm done. Whatever. Okay. I tap. So he kind of conformed to the spirit of the age. That's how I will put it. Maybe others would say he was enlightened and now his consciousness has been elevated. I think it's more that he's conformed to the spirit of the age. But that being said, I love his novels and his short stories and his poetry. But in his Port William, I should call it Port Arthur, Port William novels, it really has a sense of these sort of small, local, rural communities. And if you spend any time in these communities, you can find we as cosmopolitan people could go in there and not like the way they use language or maybe, you know, there are probably, you know, traditions in those communities that would be shocking to us. I can say I recently had this experience somewhere in the deep South in a little community. And I was kind of like, oh, how is this even possible today?
Right.
Right. And my friend was just ranting sort of about this community and this changed everything on how she saw the whole community. And I said, listen, we all have our prejudices.
Right.
And they all seem to be getting along fine and they were beautiful and charming. And I'm not going to go there and just say that it's a wicked community, you know. And, but if you, you know, if you read Wendell Berry's novels, it just has this sort of this simple, quiet beauty. And those of us who want to defend the local communities, it's not that we're blind to the past and some of the dark remnants of the past that are brought today through our various traditions. But that we recognize that using napalm, if your garden has weeds, you don't napalm the garden. Like, right? Like, you do the slow, hard, delicate work of weeding the garden, which is the gospel. And it maybe is just in our own self. Like, we weed our own garden.
Right.
Or to what Dallas Willard, I think you were quoting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idle talk in French coffee shops led to the French killing fields. That's true. And that's why for me, Gerard helped me with two things. Number one is he gave me my instructions. Whenever I see rocks descending on a lone victim, go stand next to the person. That's it. Don't ask any questions. If I see someone suffering, being doxxed, destroyed, scapegoated, I don't ask anything. I just go stand with them, period. That's the one thing I got from Gerard. And when you do that, you will become indistinguishable to the mob from the victim. So don't ever have any hopes of being popular or liked or have an easy life, you know? And so that to me is what I got from Gerard. And
interesting.
Right. And if you do that, you might stand next to a scoundrel from time to time. Right.
Right.
But you know what you'll never do?
What?
You'll never stand idly by when a mob abuses an innocent person. Or worse yet, you'll never be one of those people throwing a rock at an innocent person. So,
right. Here's a question, though, Jason.
Uh-huh.
This is, I think, again, circling back to the problem of having a global narrative accusing a scapegoat. How do you know they're innocent if it's not local?
Well, that's true. And I think most of our opportunities to stand with scapegoats are going to be local, right? So,
yes, I agree.
You know, and depending on your community, oh, he's a MAGA supporter. Oh, animal, monster, you know, go stand with them. He's a Christian baker who won't bake cakes for someone who's gay. Oh, or he's gay. Whatever. I stand with the person they're pointing at and throwing rocks at. Just go stand with them.
Right.
And by the way, I don't even ask if they're innocent.
Okay, so you're the principal, because
I assume they are. If a mob is throwing rocks at people, they're definitely powerless.
Right. That's a very good point. Right. So people always make people all throughout, not to get too political, but you know, people made this comparison between Trump and Hitler over and over again. And I do see some of the comparisons in the sense that, like, he's the person in power, the president. But in Hitler's time, was the media just, like, crushing Hitler? Like, I feel like there's so many reasons why it's very different that I never felt, I don't know.
You know, honestly, I don't see the comparisons other than those who are in power today find him distasteful. I mean, I don't find anyone in American politics like Hitler ever. Or, you know, this is the Anglo-American political community. There's never going to be anyone that's like Hitler. Can we agree on that? Like, there's never, we speak English. We have different history and traditions. Language is very important. The concepts that are carried in the words that we have. We will never have a Hitler. Never. That being said.
That's comforting.
Yeah, never. Well, we could never have someone who's just like Hitler in any way. Germany could never have that even again. Right? I mean, that was a different time.
Right.
The influence of Prussia on the rest of German culture. I think the English-speaking world has had a big impact on Germany, obviously, since World War II. So Germany would never have anyone like Hitler. It's just kind of a weird thing to say. It just, what does that even mean? I don't even know what that means. But what I will say is I think what the ruling class found distasteful about Trump, they love Trump, by the way. Remember, Oprah picked Trump as her top five humans of all time. And he was one of her last, I think her last guest, definitely in her last week of guests, because she admired him so much. And he was
when was that?
In the early 2000s or late 90s when she did her last show, her last week of shows.
Okay.
You know, what's interesting is the deplorables, I think the MAGA crowd, who are those folks? They're very ethnically diverse, ideologically diverse. I think if you look at, he got more black vote, more Latino vote, more of the gay support than any Republican ever. And I think the reason why, at least since Eisenhower, for sure. And the reason why was Trump spoke, whether it was a tactic or he's inclined to fight against bullies for the vulnerable, he spoke for those people that were left without a voice. And sort of the distasteful white American working class who the ruling elite looked down on, when Trump stood with them, they saw him like them. And they think they're all a bunch of Nazis. So Trump's defending them. Trump must be a Nazi because they loved Trump before. So they look at the American working class with disdain, and Trump dared stand with them. So then all of a sudden they despised Trump.
Right. Yeah. You know, it's so complicated in my brain because it's like, on one hand, I love Wendell Berry and I believe in everything he says about farming, local farming. And I haven't read enough to pin him down in terms of, like, is he anti-capitalist? Like, what? But I'm kind of just not concerning myself with those, you know, more abstract, but like large concepts, and just focusing on, like, okay, I see what you're saying. Like, a lot of the people you're describing, the contempt for, how did you classify the MAGA people?
Well, Hillary Clinton, they call themselves deplorables, but they call themselves that because Hillary Clinton said Donald Trump is pandering to the deplorables.
Okay. So in your opinion, do you think that, like, when Wendell Berry talks about the local farmer, is that a deplorable?
Yeah, what's interesting is, I think, look, Wendell Berry is one of these people that will do no harm. And I think that's probably his guiding principle in life. He's such a beautiful, gentle soul who has lived such a humble life, such a small life, when he had the world presented to him. Like Wendell Berry had the world laid out before him, right? And he chose, I mean, I think he doesn't even have electricity in his house. I think everything he uses is wood burning. Like, it's been a decade. I was taken aback with some of his changes about a decade ago. But prior to that, I went through a full-on Wendell Berry phase. And see, there's my dog barking. Why? Because of a delivery man. If we shop local, I wouldn't have my dog barking right now. But Wendell Berry, you know, everyone needs to read Wendell Berry. And when you read Wendell Berry, what you get is a man who is thoughtful of the other.
Yeah.
And doesn't want to hurt the other. I may disagree with him, and not even in a very stark way, but in a nuanced way on agriculture. I do think I'm not one of these people that come out with a broad brush and hate big ag. I don't think people who work for big ag are vile. I think these are beautiful human beings, the farmers and the scientists and the food scientists. These are people who are like, how do we make the most amount of food with the least amount of water on the least amount of land to feed the most amount of people? And when we look at hunger and starvation in the past 50 years, you can say these people played a big role in feeding the world.
Right.
And although I do, my children only eat organic, but you know, I recognize that's a privilege. That's a privilege. It's an opportunity, but I'm not, you know, so I don't know. I think Wendell Berry may, and I don't even want to speak for him, but I do think he's definitely an advocate of small. Local, small.
Yes. Yeah. But, and I'm kind of fascinated by it because I feel in my tribe, which does span every ideology. I mean, it's like there's almost nothing I can say all across the board that would apply to everyone. But there are certain things I feel I can say that will at least be tolerated or respected. But going back to what you said about standing next to the person having rocks thrown at them, I have that inclination too. You know, if I'm in an environment where anyone is the outsider, I have the tendency to just advocate for them or play devil's advocate on something that I don't even agree with for their sake so that they feel comfortable. And, but I have noticed, like, it's in my sphere, like, I can't say I was defending, if I went on social media and I like defended someone who was at a Trump rally, I would be seen as a Trump supporter and therefore a deplorable myself. And it's what's so interesting is like, and I did actually, there was one post where I was just like, okay, like, let's not, like, because I felt that my friends were actually getting like so crazy and shamey, and they don't even know that what they're saying and doing, because honestly they're being like fed at the bottle of these news sources that are just like catering to their, or like fanning the flame of their emotions, and it's all this vicious cycle. But it's like I can't even come to someone's defense without also becoming the scapegoat myself. And so I like what you said about that, because it helps me adjust my expectations. Like, if I'm going to live my life that way, and if I'm going to come to the defense of the most vulnerable, then maybe I should expect a lot of rocks thrown at me too.
No, and that's what Gerard also helped me understand when he said, just be in solidarity with the vulnerable is to become vulnerable.
Right.
And if you find that your work to serve the vulnerable brings you social prestige, wealth, or power, you're a victimist feigning concern for the vulnerable. To me, the worst thing in the world is to be a victimist, a do-gooder.
Right.
God forbid I use the vulnerable for wealth or prestige. I'd rather be a con man trying to sell timeshares to wealthy people or something, right?
Right.
But can you imagine, God forbid, especially with the groups I work with, they're truly the most powerless people in the world, from the child in the womb to the Yazidi to the Uyghur. Could you imagine how repulsive of a human being I would be if it was really just some sort of charade for wealth, power, and fame? And then, you know, like with what we do with my movies or whatever, wealth or power maybe has never come my way, but people do kind of get to know you, and it freaks me out. I'm like, ah, no, Lord, please, no. Because I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be a victimist, you know, where if you, right. Your fame comes from your art and your, you know, your beautiful voice and your creative writing. If any fame ever came my way, it would really just be because of my work for the vulnerable. And that really gives me chills. It scares me. It actually scares me because you could become like the worst possible human being on earth. That's what a victimist is, really. Like, you, that would be reprehensible. And I think all of us have that. It's a thin line, right? It's a very thin line, and you have to really gauge yourself. And if you're not taking risks, and what I'll say I'm proud of this. When I first started advocating for the Uyghur, I hate even saying this out loud, because they're Muslim, I got a lot of kickback from people around me.
Mm.
And over time, even Steve Bannon said when I was on his show that it was your relentless advocacy for the Uyghur that changed the direction of the Trump administration's treatment to the Uyghur or front shelving of the Uyghur. Hmm. And that really made me happy because, you know, that came at a social cost to me, I guess.
In what way?
I don't know. I don't ever feel – I honestly, I don't ever feel it. I assume that it does. Like, so, you know, some of my positions that sort of kick against type or what people expect, like my advocacy for the Dream Act or fighting for the Uyghur, I always expect that it'll come with some sort of cost, and it doesn't. I haven't.
Interesting.
I haven't felt it. Maybe it does, and I just don't know. Or maybe I've just, the nature of how I've structured my organization protects me from that I do just sort of have my own little crazy tribe that wants to go stand next to everyone having rocks thrown at them. But like you said, though, most of where it takes the most courage, and a celebrity friend of mine told me this yesterday. She said, Jason, we were talking about scapegoating and cancel culture, and she said, I've been asking myself this. She said, and you came to my mind, would I be willing to stand with Jason if they slandered him and lied about him in public?
Wow.
She said, and I told myself, yes, I would.
Aww.
And I said, well, what if they say something that's true? Because that's what they do. They can tell the truth, right?
Yeah.
They can tell the truth.
Yeah.
And she goes, yeah, I'll still stand with you. And I'm like, good. You know, because, but for me, it's more about, I just don't want to hurt people. I have a fear of hurting vulnerable people. And I don't want to be that. I don't want to be that guy. So if the mob, even if you're wrong, you have no fear of hurting people in the mob. You're not going to hurt them.
Right. Yeah, I love that quote in I See Satan Fall Like Lightning. It says, only one man can be king, but everyone can share in the persecution of a victim. And there's this really kind of sick energy this year where I feel that people actually feel more powerful persecuting the victim, which they perceive to not be innocent. So they feel justified in their persecution, but it's like, it's this sickness where, you know, we have every opportunity to get offline, like start looking at the things around us, but we actually are drawn to the negative. And I think even on a spiritual perspective, it's, I've had to take responsibility for why am I drawn to the negative? Why, when I see a news headline that's negative, I want to click on it. I want to know about it. When I see a Facebook thread where people are fighting, I want to see it, right? Like, what is that in me? And why am I like that? Why is everyone like that? And obviously the news companies know, like, they're going to profit off of that. That's what's going to sell ads. That's what's going to get clicks. And I think like this is the main area that I've been inspired to create art about, because like you mentioned, your friend who would stand with you, people are privately thinking so many things that they feel they can't talk about online. And this specific art project that I have coming out on April 9th, I think is going to be like, I'm expecting old, maybe, but I'm inspired by what you said that, you know, you kind of expect for the worst, but it doesn't always happen. I'm really looking forward to finding people who are in whatever their ideology, wherever they are on the spectrum. I want to attract people who are against cancel culture. Well, and I think that there are a lot of people like that.
Well, let me give you the good news that no one ever thinks about. When you stand with the vulnerable and they throw rocks at you, right? What does the mob do to their victims? What does Gerard say? What do we do to our victims?
What?
We deify them.
Ooh.
So we're just a couple years away from being deified. So yeah, they stone us to death. I promise you, in our lifetime, everyone that has been canceled will be deified. Watch.
You really think so?
I know so. I'm making it my project. I actually am developing a documentary where we resurrect and deify the victims of cancel culture. I want to be a part of it.
That is incredible.
I want to be a part of it. Look,
I have been wondering, like, where are all the people who have been canceled? Where are they going? Like, are they forming their own new coalition?
It's beautifully liberating. You know, I'm so glad you quoted that quote from Gerard, because I'm telling you, I thought of that quote today. I was reading Acts, and I thought, this is the thought I had in Acts. You know how they always appeal to the king or Caesar?
Yeah.
You know, they're like, oh,
yeah,
he's denying the king. Let us stone him. And I thought, the mob has figured it out. They're actually they actually get to be king, because now we appeal to the demos. They're denying the mob. Kill them. So we get to be king. Now we get to be king. And we get to participate in say the quote one more time.
Only one man can be king, but everyone can share in the persecution of a victim.
So now we all get to be king, and we all get to persecute the victim.
Right. Jason, that's so brilliant. I think that's
the appeal now, right? The appeal now is, if Acts were written today, it wouldn't be, you're denying Caesar. It'd be like, you're denying us, the mob, the spirit of the age. How dare you? Not that the mobs in Acts cared about Caesar. They just wanted the authority of Caesar. Do you remember when they found out Paul was a Roman citizen, and they freaked out? They're like, we better not kill him. There was fear. They needed permission first, right? They needed permission first, because he wasn't powerless. You have to be powerless and innocent to be a good victim. Then we kill you. Then we kill you. Then we deify you.
Wow.
So black conservatives, gay conservatives, you know, whatever, any weird group that you can really take and leave alone, separate. The Uyghur are perfect. A Turkic Caucasian Muslim in the way of global progress, because they happen to live over rare earth minerals that we need for all of the electronic crap we want. Powerless, without any defenders in the world. Innocent. Perfect victim. The perfect victim. So we need to stand. So, and I think the gospel in the social space is standing with the true victim, not the acceptable victim.
Right.
Which is just an idol, but the real victim, the real scapegoat.
So fascinating. Wow. I really like that twist on the thought that the mob is king. Because, I mean, obviously that we've seen that this year, but the awareness that the mob knows that they're king. And I actually, I had a dream, which this is, I like to be careful or sometimes private about prophetic dreams that I have, because,
I'm not going to tell anyone.
I don't know if your listeners are
they're big mouths. They're going to blab it around. I got to give you a fair
that's
news.
Okay.
They're going to blab it around. Okay, go on.
All right, great. I have had this. Are your listeners, they're all across the board.
Can I tell you about my audience, honestly?
Yes, please tell me.
I have. So my goal, now we have an audience of about 80,000 people. So it started in my garage in Hawaii, and now we've moved it to my office with heating and air conditioning in Texas. Much better. And my goal was to find my tribe. And who is my tribe? Those who want to stand with the vulnerable. The vulnerable are not weak. I want to say that. I always say that. There are strong people placed in impossible situations. And I want to find my tribe. So now this audience is huge, and our audience is all over the world. We have a big audience across the Middle East, across Asia, across Africa. Of course, Europe is huge. And this week, I always find new countries just erupt. And I have this, you know, program. I can see who's, you know, where they're listening, how many downloads in this country. And so, you know, we're across, it's interesting. We've had a big audience, and for a very long time in Norway and Sweden, have been two of our biggest countries where we're always charting there. We just charted, and we were, I think, in the top 10 in Iceland this week of podcasts. And wow. I never noticed Iceland on the map before. Not, I mean, I've noticed that there was a country called Iceland on the map. I never noticed much of an audience or of an audience at all in Iceland. And in the past couple of weeks, it's just erupted. So Iceland, welcome to the show. By the way, it's the one country in the world that I haven't been to that I really want to go. Bring me there, and I will bring my pillows. But so we have a very global audience. It's also, I always say this is not a Catholic podcast, but people tell me it is. But we have a huge Muslim audience, Protestant audience, very diverse. Well, I shouldn't say that because I don't think we're diverse at all. Like, this is an audience, and I know because I get these beautiful letters from India, from, you know, all over the world. And these are people that are just really thoughtful of trying to live a life of service to the vulnerable. And, wow. You know, many of them are vulnerable too. Like, we all are, let's be honest now. That's something else I read. I'm just, you know, I want something else I read in Acts today that I saw a lot today I never saw before. Like, when Paul got stoned, left for dead, wakes up, goes to the next city, and they're like, so what happened there? He goes, it was amazing. It was like, God is really moving there. He never even brought up that they stoned me half to death and left me out for dead. He was just, it was great. And that's my audience. You know, I think wow. It's an audience that all has a sense of justice experience because they experience profound personal injustice themselves or in their own community. So we have a huge Uyghur audience, Kurdish audience, Christians across the Middle East. And so I'm finding my folks, people who were vulnerable, who were like me. When I remember that day this all started for me, lonely, broken, powerless to defend my first child from lethal violence, murdered, and broken, weak. And that moment has illuminated the rest of my life that I don't want anyone to feel like I felt at that moment. So I want to find every person like that guy that was me. And I want to stand with them. That's who that's who you're talking to when you're on the Jason Jones Show.
Got it. I really admire that. And as an artist, I aspire to be brave enough to really be that person because, I'll be honest, the worlds that I'm in are very homogenous in their thinking. And I'm prepared to be a transgressive artist. The kind of work I've been doing quietly, have not even been posting about, has been, I've been doing the work of preparing to be hated by certain people, but at the same time, I really believe that I'm taking this extra time to create language around what I'm trying to say that is inclusive, and I want to be able to talk about something, even how I mentioned the difference between the online space versus the poetry reading, physical, in-person space. Like, there really is just such a difference between the two. And so as an artist, I've been quiet in a lot of respects as I'm working on these different projects. But the one that's coming on April 9th is about echo chambers. And it'll be a photograph. And I'll let the photograph be a surprise. But we're going to have five liberals, five conservatives look at this photograph, and then we'll film a roundtable discussion of their feelings on it. And the photograph itself is pretty transgressive. I think that I'm excited about it because artistically it's so interesting. It has like this minimal elegance to it, and I'm collaborating with a world-class photographer, Andrew Matusik. He's been published in Italian Vogue and Vogue and all of this. Celebrity photographer, incredible, and this amazing art director, Annie Laurie Mills. She's worked on TV shows and films, and we're creating this image together, and I'm just excited to have this conversation about echo chambers with a fair representation of both sides. And I also am curious, like I'm kind of treating it as an experiment, but this conversation is inspiring to me because I'm aware, like this local global video in its own way, like I didn't promote it that much because I knew certain people would be like, well, I'm glad your local year was amazing. Mine was this way. Or, you know, maybe they would perceive the fact that I was still seeing people as wrong by the mob standards or whatever the thought process might be. So I shied away from posting about it too much.
Well, I'm here to wreck your plan. Sorry. I didn't know that was the plan. Okay, sorry.
Well, I'm now rescinding the plan because after I did the performance, it just got worse and worse and worse. And that's when I started being proactive in, instead of just looking at my network and saying, who's going to cancel me? I started saying, who is speaking as a moderate, including dialogue, including voices who are different from their own. And maybe not even changing their own opinion, not changing their principles, because I think it's beautiful to have your principles, whatever they might be, if you can defend them well. And if they, you know, lead to a flourishing life, community, political society, and how do we even find those truths and principles without debating them? Half of the best ideas I've come across have been from conversations with people who are in complete disagreement with me in terms of my principles. So I just am like such a defender of searching for truth instead of approaching a topic as if you already have the truth. Like I love leading with a question and it's so enriching. So I'm in some ways I'm excited, but I'm also scared because I've committed, like all of these things are in the calendar, these shoots and this event. So it's going to happen and we're going to see whether or not I get canceled.
Well, you know, and if you are canceled, can I tell you what's good that comes along with being canceled is just that beautiful experience of empathy and to begin to understand how just we live in a world of abandoned people. And most of all of us have lived very charmed lives. Have you read the book Spectacle?
I have not.
Do you know about it?
Putting it on my list.
Oh my gosh.
I've heard of it.
It's just about a man that was a black man that was placed in a cage in the Brooklyn Zoo, I believe, Bronx Zoo. It's been a while since I read it. And they sewed a tail onto him. They used to do this to Filipinos they would bring here too, as well, to the zoos in the early 20th century. Well, this guy, actually, you know what? I'm looking at my bookshelf. I'm going to grab it. Hold on. Talk to yourself, guys. Hold on. I just going to take me 2 seconds. I've never done this before.
Okay.
But this book, everyone, I don't want to get it wrong. Hold on.
While he's finding the book, I can tell you where to find me on Instagram. My artist name is Zaya, but it's spelled with an X. So it's X-E-A-H. On Instagram, it's zaya.music. And I'm also on Facebook. So I mostly... Or Dak Jason?
I didn't approve a commercial. What were you selling? Were you selling my pillows with the code Zaya? Use the code Zaya for deep discount. No, it's the code Jones. Okay. You can promote. Did you get it out? Did you get it?
I got I was just filling the silence.
Okay. So here it is. It's called Spectacle. It's on this man, Ota Benga. And this is something I would love to see made into a movie. He ended up killing himself, you know, going out into the woods in Virginia and killing himself. But these black pastors got him out of the zoo. Imagine this, watching family, robbed from your family, robbed from your friends, brought to another land, thrown into a cage, people looking at you. Unbelievable. Now, we'll never know what that's like. Right?
Right.
But you may be doxxed or destroyed, or for me, people will call me all sorts of names that don't even know me because of my politics. That's just bizarre. And then whenever that happens, I'm like, that doesn't feel good. Okay. This is how people feel every day that are slandered, you know? And right. Then I better watch my mouth. I better make sure that I never say something hurtful and cruel and untrue about somebody to gain political points. Anyway, Spectacle. It's about Ota Benga. Everyone, I need to read this book again.
But it's by?
It's by Pamela Newkirk. And it's really one of the best books I've ever read, although it's really hard to read and it's heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. But when we go through being doxxed or destroyed or canceled, they cannot cancel us, okay? It's painful, but then you just go, oh, wow, this hurts. This isn't nice at all. Like, this is unpleasant.
Right.
Especially, you know, and I think we're very close to the victims of the cancel culture being deified. I just really believe that. Where the people, I think we are, I use this word and I know it offends people because they don't know what the word means, but I think we're about to see a return of liberalism. My mission in life is to conserve liberalism, which is the idea that people are free to think and express themselves the way they want. I don't mean leftist ideology. I mean classical liberalism. And I think that we're approaching, because we're this cancel culture, every day I say, oh, can't get worse, and it gets more absurd every day. Adam Carolla said recently, white supremacy doesn't mean what it used to be. Today, all it means is you're someone not calling other people white supremacists. If you're not calling other people white supremacists, then you're a white supremacist. You need to get out there and start calling people white supremacists. So you people know you're not a white. I mean, we're living in that world where we call people the most vile things that aren't grounded in truth at all. And I feel sorry for the folks that are engaging in that. And they're going to have to look back at the rest of their life and say, I was swept up in an enthusiasm and said and did very vile things.
Yeah. And Jason, the reason why I'm picking the echo chambers as the thing to make this transgressive art about is because I genuinely, these are my friends, these people who, you know, you're saying like are swept up in it and in a way you feel bad for them. Like, I know the way they think. And I know that if they really knew what they were doing, they wouldn't do it. But the thing is, they just don't know because they're in such an echo chamber. And I have had to look at my life and think, okay, like the fact that half of everyone I know, if I'm just going to generalize it, is very left and then half is very right. And I live in the Northeast, so maybe the people that I know who are on the right aren't necessarily the far right, but I don't even really know what that means anymore, the far right and the far left. Like, I feel like everyone's either far left or far right, and there's no in between. That's like my personal experience based on the people that I know.
But can I ask you an honest question? Are their politics really much different, or is it just their tribal identification? If you were to sit them down and drill into their policies, would there be much difference?
I would say there's almost no difference in the sentiment, and then there's some difference in the execution.
So they all have the same goals. They want everyone to live happy, safe, prosperous lives. They want full legal protection for everyone. They don't want anyone to be abandoned to cruelty or hostility or injustice. That's all of us. That's who we are.
I know.
Why are we pretending that there's one side that's like that and the other's? It's insane. I think we've never been more similar as a people in our values.
And to add to that, I've always thought the tension between the two led to a healthy kind of balance. Like, that there's, I liked the tension, and I typically refer to myself as like moderate or independent. But you know, like I have values that are on the conservative side, and then I have values that are on the liberal side, but I'm not allowed to have any one of those values without being grouped into the entire ideology. And so it's like, how do I exist? Like, I feel like people who are genuinely processing things and being thoughtful are kind of being shoved to the side a little bit, because it's like, and again, it just all goes back to the way we share our news and information, because social media has taken over our sense of reality, the proportion of our perception of the proportion of say, you know, like just say conservative, like if you're in a dominantly liberal echo chamber, you'll tend to think conservatives are all racist or are all, you know, like when you see the event of storming the White House, like you think conservatives did that. And then, you know, when say you're in a conservative echo chamber, you'll be like terrified of the liberals, like, oh my gosh, they're trying to like do all these things. And I just, it's exhausting. Like, I'm telling you, I'm seriously so exhausted to the point that I have isolated myself, not even because of COVID. I can't be in conversations with people who are so reductionist in the way they categorize people. But then in order to really have a conversation about it, it always comes down to, oh, where did you get that information? Because of course, we're always talking about a global reality instead of a local one. So who told you that? Where did you get that information? And then what I'm seeing is one ideology thinks where the other people got their news is fake, and then that ideology thinks where they got their news is fake. So how could you ever have a discussion on fake news on both sides? And it's honestly, I'm like, please, the reason I've chosen to talk about it is because at the root of it, that's what's leading to this hysteria, right? Not to minimize the fact that there are real problems. In addition to that, it's just in my life, in my situation.
Yeah, but advocating for utopian ideologies and thinking and speaking only in cliches is not a good strategy to fix any problem in society.
Exactly. And I will say, the conversation that I had with my friend that went so well, the one I was talking about earlier in this podcast, the thing that we agreed on the most, and she said it, not me. She said, why do we have this expectation that we're all supposed to be on the same page? Why is there that expectation that we're all supposed to think the same exact way about X, Y, Z? Why is there that expectation? And I agreed with her, and I said, yeah, I think that the expectation should be, in your local context, you live out the way that you want to live. Like, if we have the freedom to do that, then that's the best case scenario. Because of course I would love to live in a world where everyone thought the right way about everything, but that is completely impossible. And that's why I just love that you use the word utopian, because it's not even an option. Like, when I'm looking to buy a house, I don't look at $10 million houses. Like, I don't consider it as an option because I can't afford that. So I look in the price range I can afford. And I feel like we're looking way beyond our price range.
Yeah. Well, by the way, we don't agree with, I change my mind on important things often, right?
Right.
And I have different experiences, or I come to think different way. It doesn't even make sense. We would be, if me from today got into a conversation with me from 5 years ago on Facebook, we would find a lot to argue about.
Right.
And I would block me. I'm never, he's blocked. Jason Jones from 2015 is blocked.
Right.
You know, and so it's just really, I think it's a spiritual sickness that we all are tempted to, and we must resist. And it's erupted in some sort of very strange ways and dangerous ways. And all I want is a world where kids can ride their bike in the cul-de-sac and I can barbecue. That's it. That's my goal in life. You know, we just want a peaceful, yeah. prosperous. And like you said, that's, I find that my friends who are on the all across the spectrum, like you said, you put it perfect. When it comes to ends, they have the same goals, the same ends in mind. How to achieve those ends is where they differ. And they will fight like, you know, mortal enemies over just prudential differences on how to achieve the same goals. It's so bizarre. Mm-hmm. And so now I think I am very hopeful because things have become so dark. Not that the skies aren't going to get darker and the seas won't rise higher, but I do think the storm will be breaking soon and the seas will calm down because they must. And I do think that's the Christian witness in the midst of all of this is I had to do an operational pause for my organization. It's like, what are our goals this year? Food security, advocate for, you know, the groups we're advocating for, da, 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 da. But then also it's, you know what, we're not going to attend every fight we're invited to. And what we really want to do is focus on those ends and share how we all do really have shared ends in mind and not allow our disagreements on how to achieve those ends to make it impossible to even to drift further from our goals than we were when we started.
Yes. And, you know, I've been thinking about this year as a case study for what not to do. I mean, really, I think it was so dramatic. It was so, like you said, there are aspects of it that were so absurd that I'm in a way thankful that it went down the way that it did, because specifically with the local global concept, I would have never arrived at that so quickly if it hadn't been for this year. And even the willingness to be canceled, I probably wouldn't have put my name on a list with the way that I am right now. Like, I'm preparing to make the art that I'm making regardless of who's listening. And I always knew that I was on that path. But again, as a highly sensitive person, I'm not the archetypal person who's like screaming, you know, looking for a fight. Like, I'm looking at some of these thought leaders online, and I feel like in our cultural environment, it's like the screamy kind of binary, like pigeonholed person. They seem to win, and that has been frustrating for me because I'm quiet, I'm intellectual, I'm very slow to get behind something. I do a lot of research, I do a lot of thinking, and I'm nuanced. And so I think, like, in some ways as an artist, I feel like my voice has been drowned, or I have noticed that, like, I'm not going to just say something off the top of my head if I'm going to get canceled for it, unless it's something I really want to go to bat for, right? So I think that in a way I'm looking at the positives of the year and saying, this is how it always was. Just now I can see it. It's not invisible anymore.
It's become stark. I'm excited. I think it's going to be a very fruitful year. And, you know, as artists, I am an artist of sort, I guess, as a filmmaker, I always say we're either grounded in the transcendent or we're selling soap. You know, either we're grounded in the transcendent or we work for Madison Avenue. That's it. Those are the only two choices. And if you're going to be a soap salesman, an ad salesman, if you're going to write radio copy, ad copy, just admit it. But if you're not rooted in the transcendent, if you're consumed by the spirit of the age, you're just a salesman. You're just a shyster, really. And I've noticed, I mean, your stuff, especially, we didn't get into it, but your fascination with chastity and nuns, you know, and you're not even Catholic. And your art is so cool. And it is so rooted in the transcendent that gets through the muck of the spirit of the age. But now it's, I think we have all, 2020 made it all clear for us that, you know, there's nothing edifying about reading, writing, or listening to ad copy, unless it's me trying to sell pillows, which is amazing. My pillow commercials are fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it's a conversation for another time. We could have a whole conversation on the artist turning herself into an ad. Like, that has, there's so many layers to this conversation, and I know we've already been talking for a long time, but.
We ended the show an hour ago.
Oh, we did.
No, we didn't. I'm saying an hour ago. I'm like, okay, I think we're wrapping it up. You know, my wife is in New York City caring for her father with COVID. His name's Ray. Pray for him. He's a great man, but he's battling back. So I am responsible for homeschooling, food, dinner. So I have to cook dinner. You know what I'm going to cook tonight?
What?
Chick-fil-A.
Are you going to get it or cook it?
No, I'm going to get it. I mean, I'm not cooking. I don't cook. Like yesterday it was pizza. Tomorrow will be Whataburger. When my wife comes home, my kids are going to be really overweight.
Oh, Jason, well, thank you for having me. This is a lovely conversation, and I'm just really inspired by the way you've created your tribe.
I love my tribe. It's a beautiful tribe. We're scapegoats standing together, so no one is left out.
Amazing.
You know, where no one is cold, lonely, and, you know, we live in something that you get, and I know we didn't get into your accident and what went along with that, but, those of us who've experienced, you know, sorrow, pain, suffering, depression, heartache, which is actually all of us, right? Every human being that walks the planet. And if we can tap into that and know that all of us have just had a little taste compared to what others have suffered. Mm-hmm. My friend Nick Wojcik said something I've never forgotten. I say it a lot on the show, but he, you know, do you know Nick Wojcik? He has no arms or no legs. One of the most sought after speakers in the world.
Yeah.
And was born like this. He tried to commit suicide. And while he was underwater in his bathtub dying, he had a vision of his mother seeing him dead. And he fought to get up. He fought to give up. And he get up, and he did. And something he'd never been able to do before. It was always his fear that he would slip and drown. He got up. And we were speaking at a tent revival in Mexico. And I heard him say, you know, I was always saying to God, you know, God, why don't you... I want arms, I want legs, I want a hand up. You're never there, Lord. I'm asking you for a hand up, but I don't see you. And he said, and he heard God say, you know, if I'm not giving you a hand up, it's because there's someone you need to turn around and look to and give them a hand up.
Wow.
He's like, but Lord, I don't have any hands, you know. He's like, you do, you do. Turn around and look how many people you can lift up. And Nick has lifted up how many
Jason,
people?
Chill.
Huh? How many people?
I seriously have had so many chills just in this conversation. I have to go back and journal all the different things that you said. I love how you speak in images.
Well, I've just been blessed to be surrounded by artists like you, and I just share your stories. And that was Nick's imagery that I'm sharing. And but that's all of us, no matter what we've experienced. The darkest experience that I've ever had, I've learned now to tell myself, take a photograph of this, journal it, remember this, never forget how I'm feeling right now. Because to know every day someone's feeling just like this,
right.
It's only going to last for a time for me, but tomorrow there'll be a million people feeling just like this. So that's the age we're in, and they're trying to divide us in so many ways, and we're not going to let them.
No. Amazing. Well, thank you, Jason.
Well, thank you. Now, let's say it together. Zaya. It's a cool name. Now you got.
Thank you.
Jason is just boring. Although I let the people in my house that turn the world upside down. So thank you for turning the world upside down. And I cannot wait to maybe we'll have you back on in middle of April, late April, with your new project.
Please.
And we can talk about that.
I'm going to be so excited to talk about that.
All right, I'm going to wrap this show up. You go tend to your fire, and then I have to go cook dinner, a.k.a. drive to Chick-fil-A.
All right.
All right.
Later, Jason.
Isaiah, God bless. All right, that was my dear friend, Zaya. That was one of our longest interviews. You know, when I talk to my friends, sometimes it starts out kind of strange. And then, you know, it becomes just us as friends talking. And that's what happened to this show. So I am glad you made it this far. I'm glad you listened to the whole show. You got to go into the show notes where you can listen to her video, watch her video, Monster. Millions and millions of views. Also, you can see her 2020, A Local Year in Search. It's a poetry film, and it's beautiful. We talked about a lot in this show. We talked about Wendell Berry, Rene Girard, cancel culture, and so I hope you took notes. You got to read Wendell Berry. You got to read Rene Girard. Definitely go watch Rene Girard's lectures on YouTube. It's I do all the time. One of the things I love most about YouTube is just watching lectures from professors. Professors that have passed sometimes decades ago, but their lectures are still there for free. And I can't wait for Zaya's new project. When she has that, we will have her back on. She is really one of the most talented people I know. Writer, director, music, TV, film, poet, an artist. And she's a guest we're going to have on more. Remember to support our sponsors. Of course, Movie to Movement. Movie to Movement, promoting a culture of life, love, and beauty through the power of film. Our new movie, Divided Hearts of America, was just on pay-per-view, but now is streaming everywhere. You can go buy it at Amazon.com, Google Play, wherever you download your films. Divided Hearts of America is there. And the Vulnerable People Project, go to thegreatcampaign.org. We talked about standing with the vulnerable. Become a monthly donor. Any donation of $20 or more, you get a copy of my book, The Race to Save Our Century, Five Core Principles to Creating a Culture of Life and Love and Beauty. You can get our book for a donation of $20 or more. But when you donate just $5 a month, we know you're on the team. We know you're on the tribe. We'll communicate with you. So go to thegreatcampaign.org and join us as we stand together with the vulnerable, defending the vulnerable. And of course, MyPillow. Go to MyPillow.com. Use the code Jones for deep discounts for all MyPillow products. You need the pillow. You can wash it. You know, you can wash it. It holds its shape. It doesn't get hot. You don't have to turn it back and forth all night long. The Giza Dream Sheets are a dream. And the mattress topper. If you have a lot of kids, you need that mattress topper. Not just for the mattress. You just put that down there and my kids just drag it up to the living room and they all sit on it when they play chess, play Sorry, play Risk, whatever they're doing on the mattress topper. My only fear is they're going to spill Kool-Aid on it. But probably I don't have to worry about that. My wife doesn't let them drink Kool-Aid. I would let them drink Kool-Aid. Until next time, it's the Jason Jones Show.
This has been the Jason Jones Show, powered by Mudhouse Media.